Hello, and welcome to Endeavors.
Well, I think I look like Marilyn Monroe, standing by the subway, feel the wind blow. I dream for me this far. Every day's a movie and I'm a star. You're gonna fall in love and then you're gonna fade. Everything changes in seventh grade. You stand in a circle pretending to inhale. Every situation you're a different girl. You held my hand, I was a little girl. Everything is sacred in a broken world.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Endeavors. The song you heard there was Marilyn Monroe by the duo Dala off their 2007 album, Who Do You Think You Are? I feel a little bit like this show has become a bit of an exercise in vanity for me, because I just seem to be interviewing people that I'm fans of. The other day I talked to Glenn Morshower, formerly of 24, and yesterday I talked with Colin Mochrie and Brad Sherwood of Whose Line Is It Anyway? And earlier today I talked with Wes Studi. Not that there's anything wrong with, you know, artists that you're fans of. I don't know. I've been thinking a lot about it lately. I bring this up because Dalla has always been one of those groups for me. Sheila Carabine, who is one half of Dalla, along with Amanda Walther, spoke with me a couple of days ago about their career, and they're playing a show tomorrow night here in Toronto. And I first saw Dalla back in 2007 when they opened for Matthew Good, actually promoting this album, Who Do You Think You Are? And I really, really liked them. And I got to meet them in 2012, interview both of them in person for the Vancouver Folk Fest. And I don't know, that was the first time that I just felt that I was meeting an artist that I really, really, truly adored. And Dalla hasn't released, their last album was released in 2012, but they're still making music. But they've always held a special place for me. And so I was really excited to get to interview Sheila again after all these years, even though she had, you know, why would she remember who it was? Anyway, I don't know what compelled me to tell this story, but I've just been thinking a lot about the people that I've been having on lately and sort of what this show has become for me. And I sort of feel caught between, you know, an interviewer, a journalist, and an exercise in vanity. I am thrilled that Sheila is on the show today. I didn't get a chance to ask her about her solo album. I felt bad, but in addition to her work with Dalla, Amanda and Dalla, she also has a solo album out called All In. And you'll be hearing from her in about half an hour from now. My first guest, though, is somewhat of a legend in the horror industry. It's funny, talking about people that I've interviewed recently, it seems that a lot of the interviews I'm getting lately are horror film people. And there's nothing wrong with that. I love horror. I didn't necessarily expect that I'd become the horror guy, and I still don't think I am, but I really enjoyed my interview with Jonathan Sketch earlier this year. I've talked with, you know, I did a lot of horror festivals last year, so it seems to be a very natural progression. And Larry Fessenden has been a longtime actor, writer, director, and producer in the horror film genre. While most people would know him as an actor, he has directed 4 or 5 films of his own and has produced countless others. He's in a very, very intriguing new horror film called Like Me, in which he stars opposite the brilliant Addison Timlin. Now, at times the interview, there was some interference, so the quality kind of goes up and down. It doesn't necessarily interrupt his speech. You can understand him. It might become a bit of a distraction, I should say. But this is me with the great Larry Fessenden. Larry Fessenden, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here today.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here.
So, you're in a new movie.
like me, you play the hotel manager, and you're also an executive producer. And you do that a lot. You play a lot of roles simultaneously. Were you always going to have a role in this film as well as produce?
No, it's a great question. I appreciate it because, in fact, the movie came together with Addison Timlin in the lead, and that was very exciting. And we were trying to find someone for the character of Marshall. We were going to produce at a low budget, and that was plenty of work to do. One day, the director, Robert Mockler, invited me out for a beverage, and I assumed he wanted to ask my counsel as a first-time director. I would, you know, help him with getting over the jitters. Then he said he'd recently watched an old film of mine called Habit, and he wanted to propose that I play Marshall. So it was very nice. Just came out of the blue, was not the original intention. And I had to think about it, but then thought it was a great opportunity.
How would you describe your character? Because he's sort of kind of falls in this line between victim and accomplice, I find.
Right, and I think that's the point. These are two loners. I mean, obviously the backdrop is our very contemporary world of social media, and that's obviously where the title comes from. But it's really an older tradition of people who feel outside of society. And it's obvious that Marshall, it unfolds slowly, but that he suffered from some terrible personal tragedies, and probably because of his own shortcomings, which are the worst kind, I guess, because you start to suffer from self-loathing. And I think he's very isolated as the hotel manager, and then along comes this spunky character who makes a lewd proposal, which he can't really control himself, and goes along with it. And then they become accomplices in loneliness and kind of sparring partners, and it's kind of a classic abusive relationship. I mean, you know, Bonnie and Clyde had their own problems as well. It's not what you particularly remember about the movie, but, you know, they their romance was kind of screwed up. So it's that kind of picture.
There's an article that I read that has a great quote to describe it, which is, or at least Addison's character is connected while at the same time being disconnected. Is that where you think we're at in terms of the impact with social media, that we're connected to the world and each other, but maybe a little bit disconnected from reality in many ways?
Well, it's quite funny to ask. I can tell you that I actually have a website called Disconnects with an X at the end, and it's sort of what I call my political website, in which I suggest that humanity has become disconnected from reality and nature and the real rhythms of, you know, the fact that we're creatures on this earth. And I think it really is the downfall of the species. And so I like just that you're phrasing it that way. I do think that was Rob's intention, to talk about, you know, how social media gives the impression that we're all connected and staying engaged with each other. But I think there's a greater disconnect. I also think loneliness is the human condition. You can never quite know what someone else is experiencing, and you know, issues of empathy and all the political conversation is also affected by that. You know, our country's run by a narcissist right now, and that is a very damaging personality trait that can lead to you know, greater bad decisions. So, you know, these are all important topics, and I do like the term disconnect, because I think if you stop understanding how you are part of a greater web of life, it leads to trouble.
Now, Rob Mockler, who is the director of the film, I believe this is his first feature. And what was it like for you working with the first-time director, not only as an actor, but on the producer side of things as well?
Well, obviously, you know, an association begins because I was inspired by his ideas, his vision. He had made a short film depicting a scene from the script that I thought was really well crafted. And, you know, the script itself was interesting. And then clearly when you speak with him, you can see the ideas he's struggling with, the influences that he brings to the table, and all of that becomes very interesting. Then what you need to do is give him the support system so he can express those ideas and follow through. And, you know, believe me, no matter how seasoned a director, you always have doubt, you have budget restraints, time restraints. So, you know, the role of the producer is to provide as safe a zone as you can while still acknowledging there are things they can't get. And then you walk them through those disappointments and help them find alternatives. So it's a process I enjoy. I like the fresh talent when people are still searching and open and trying to sort of capture that bit of inspiration that got them interested to become artists or filmmakers. So that's sort of why I keep coming back to these first-time directors and second-time directors.
This film obviously deals a lot with technology. How do you think technology has affected film in recent years? Not, I mean, social media aspect is one thing, but also from a distribution point of view, has streaming even made film more mainstream and harder for indies to get out there, or has it made it easier?
Well, there are different levels, of course. The first thing when you propose the question I think about is the cameras, the amount of lighting that you need now to capture an image. If you use the A7S or other cameras that really can see in the dark, that means there's less, that means the lighting becomes mostly about crafting the image rather than even getting an exposure. So that's changed things. We're much more mobile. I love the new LED lights. They don't give out a lot of heat. They're very compact. They can, you know, the color temperature can be controlled. So a lot of that is great. And then on the other side, you have the computer editing, which, you know, has been around since the 80s. But now it's just assumed that that's how you'll cut your film. And it's important for my generation, we did cut on celluloid. And so you had to really be very specific in your choices. I think that's the only thing that you could say negative about modern technology is you don't have to be as precise because you can sort of roll footage and you're not being as decisive. But that's all of that. And then when you get to the streaming, I mean, look, I'm old-fashioned. I like owning a Blu-ray of a movie that I love. But I think the new generation just expects it all to stream. My only caution is that, you know, one day the internet will go down and then we won't have anything. It's also very hard to get the money back for these small films. In the old days, in the 90s, I could make these small movies and then you'd have a video deal, a TV deal, hopefully a theatrical experience. And now you're really knocking at the door of Netflix or Amazon, Hulu. It just makes the numbers harder to achieve. So you have to work cheaper, and that's fine, but it's hard to sustain crew, you know, if they want to grow up and have kids, you know. And so it's a tough business. The middleman is, the middle class is being squeezed out, in a sense. You're either on a huge Hollywood movie or you have to be a kid who lives with roommates. I don't know the answer.
I know that a lot of the films that you've made, that you've directed, deal with American exceptionalism, and I feel like we're seeing that taken to the extreme by the current government. Do you find any correlation with horror and society in the fact that they're both driven and based off fear?
Well, I do think that horror films highlight the fact that most of society, most of human interaction is actually run by fear. We'd love to say it's run by love, and I certainly celebrate sentimental movies in a certain way, but I think we have to acknowledge that we're creatures, you know, with reptile brains. And unfortunately, in America, they're the two personalities. There's the higher aspirations of hope and all the rhetoric that we grow up with, but then there's sort of the political landscape, which is driven by fear-mongering, and that's what allows for racism and all of the other cancerous aspects of our society. So I think it's important for horror films to, in one way or another, address fear head-on and hopefully to shake people out of their complacency. I think the modern technology and the media landscape just creates an endless babble of meaningless conflict, and there's an almost entitled quality, like we're all above it all. But in fact, back to our earlier conversation, we're actually connected to the earth. The climate is a big deal to me, and I try to do that in a couple of movies just to put human society in context and to remind us that we have to have humility and respect for the for Mother Nature, that old sawhorse. But it's true. People think they're above it all, and they're wrong.
You've made your living for the most part in the horror genre. What first attracted you to this area of filmmaking? And are you okay with your status as an icon for horror fans?
Well, you can't disparage being called an icon. That's a very endearing label that's been applied to me. I'm not even sure why, but it is funny to read it every time and to think, well, I'm not sure where that came from. But I don't mind being associated with horror because it is sort of an outsider genre, even though now there's it's sort of a moment when Get Out is being celebrated, Guillermo's film Shape of Water. That's two fantasy films in the Oscar running. That's somewhat unusual. I do think it's an essential genre, and I like that it sort of, comes from a very visceral outsider place with people like Romero and really James Whale all the way back to the early Frankenstein director. You know, these people were showing the dark side of humanity, which people sort of like to brush under the rug. So I think it's a very essential genre, and it's the one that keeps on giving because society needs a way to express their fears. So obviously I also have other sides to me. I'd love to do a musical, but you have to accept the tiny little slice of the pie that you get. And I'm happy to be associated with horror, and I can speak passionately about its role and its, how it's vital.
What do you make of Get Out? Because that's been called an unconventional horror film, and then here it is nominated for Best Picture, Best Screenplay, and Best Director.
Yeah, well, I find this endless hand-wringing over labels to be extremely aggravating, and sort of what I mean about the endless media noise. I mean, they just have to make a mountain out of every molehill. Get Out is a horror film. There's even, mad scientist scenes in that movie. That's what Gordon Peele was doing, is using that framework to make a movie that ends up obviously commenting on racism, but that's what's fun about it. You would be able to recognize it if he made a Western about racism, so why can't we call it a horror film? That's just the framework in which he's made an original and fun movie. And also, it just shows that horror can allow you to talk about something that might otherwise seem loaded or heavy. I mean, obviously, they make all kinds of movies that address racism, so why not a horror film? Yeah, so I think it's a fantastic moment to have it recognized for also a quality, I would call it a B-movie, but that's a celebration. It's a quality B-movie, and it has strong themes. I've always said in my company, we like to make B-movies with A-movie themes, and here's a perfect example. That's what Get Out is.
I think you've stated in the past that it's being remembered is sometimes better than being paid. How can money ruin the filmmaking experience, or does it in any way?
Yes, it does every time. It actually is a horrible aspect of showbiz on all levels. You know, when I was growing up, it was less known, the budget. I mean, I remember when Jaws was made, they talked about it, and certainly when it made a lot of money, they talked about it. But it's hard for people to recognize that society does change. You know, now they publish the 10 most successful movies in just the regular newspaper. You know, I suppose on Monday morning or something, they say, what was the weekend grosses? The public didn't know all that before, but it puts a monetary value on the art, and it means that, you know, and they immediately say that Blade Runner 2049 is a failure, and you're just very aware of this sort of aspect. So we're seeing the public is being encouraged to see movies through this business aspect, and I think that's damaging. That isn't the emphasis we had in the 70s and obviously years before that. And then on the other side, raising money for an unexpected script is extremely painful now. They just want famous actors. It's always about the acting, always about the tax breaks. You know, it's rarely about taking the risk. So, you know, it's just a more cautious society. There's a huge glut of media because of what we discussed earlier, the technology. A lot of people can make movies. It used to be a mysterious and rarefied activity. When I was growing up, I didn't really know how you would become a filmmaker. That seemed like something that other people did in Hollywood, and you went to the movies. And now you can at least imagine making a movie and having access to a film festival. So for someone growing up now, there's the opportunity for a lot of hope. But the actual economics of becoming a working filmmaker seems, I think, very mysterious. I don't know how that will work.
I read that part of what attracted you to producing and filmmaking was getting to witness other people's process, and I'm curious, how did observing others help you in your own style and your own filmmaking?
I don't know. I actually have my own process. I think what I really would say about producing is that I just enjoy the artistic process and hanging out with people and seeing how they see something and helping them strengthen their approach. You know, just like a simple example, if somebody believes in a long take or someone else believes in fractured editing, these are all just such fun conversations to have because you're engaging with the language of cinema and how all of that works. I love the acting process. Some actors act from the outside in, you know, they develop a limp or a lisp. You know, another actor is very much in the method. So it's really just very privileged experience to work with other people who are trying to pursue an idea, try to understand the language. You know, everyone knows that I love Hitchcock because he spoke about movies and how you the effect of your choices on an audience. So that's the kind of conversation I enjoy. So it's not so much that I'm, but of course, yes, you're learning every time you talk to someone. You're going, oh, that's interesting. Now that you put it that way, I guess that's worth considering. So it's all about collaboration and community and communication. The three C's. I've created a new class for my students. And, you know, I think that's important to just, it's all part of the journey, you know.
I know at one point you were involved with you were co-writing the Orphanage remake with Del Toro. Are you still involved with that at all? What is happening exactly with that project?
That was just a very fantastic period in my life. I had finished a movie called The Last Winter. I was producing a lot of films with Jim Mickle and Ty West, and then Guillermo invited me to write the script with him of the American remake. issue, and we had an excellent 6 or 8 months writing the script together, which I enjoyed thoroughly. Speaking of just the pleasure of collaboration with such a thoughtful, fun person. And then we cast for another 6 or 8 months. I had New Line, very enthusiastic. They loved the script. And I couldn't seem to land a major actress, which was part of the plan for the movie, of course, for financing. And eventually they felt that maybe it was because of my track record that they couldn't get a major actress interested. So they moved on, and they had another director in place. And then that didn't really catch. And it actually speaks a little bit about the idea of trying to make dignified horror movies. Obviously, Guillermo can pull it off, but then to have his disciples bear the same respect doesn't necessarily translate. And that's often the case. You know, you make your own reputation. It's not always possible as a producer to pass your reputation to the next level. So I lost the project, and then eventually the new director didn't really get any traction either. So I don't know. It's still a great script. I would love to see it made, but I don't know if they'll find a reason to pick it up again. It's an interesting thing. Guillermo himself has said something that's so important. The natural state of a movie is it not getting made. And you have to know how many movies don't get made. It's actually quite heartbreaking, and it's a real eye-opener. People who think, oh, those showbiz types just flittering through life. Well, it's not true. It's an incredibly difficult job, and mostly filled with heartbreak.
What was the Del Toro experience like for you, just getting to work with him?
It's hard to describe anything so wonderful. I mean, you go to his house. I was going to his house in Northern California, and it's not even his house. It's his, you know, his workspace. So it's a beautiful little two-story house with all these monsters in it and little shrines to the great directors, and there's a Jaws shrine and a shrine to Frankenstein's monster and a shrine to Hitchcock and a shrine to illuminated manuscripts, and they're just books and books and books, and then of course Guillermo's own props. So it's this wonderful, it's like a kid's room filled with tchotchkes and trinkets, but also a great wealth of genre knowledge and gothic literature. And so here you are in this fantastic atmosphere, and then he speaks with great authority. He has a real access to all the tropes of mythological story structure and how things function. And so it was fun to talk to, you know, a story with someone with that depth of knowledge. And then also he brought personal anecdotes to our thinking. For example, his father was kidnapped in Mexico, and he had an opinion about how that could play into our story, how the mediums that come and say, we'll help you find your child in the story, how they're sort of predators, and they go to a house that's suffering from some kind of grief, and they insert themselves into the lives. So this was something he was drawing on from his own experience. So it was just a very rich collaboration. I mean, really what would happen is we'd just sit and talk for an hour, and then I would go and write. And I did all the writing, but then he would sort of be critiquing and offering his insight. And that only lasted for a week in person, and then a couple of months back and forth, you know, on the internet and phone calls. So it was a very wonderful experience.
Horror fans are some of the most passionate in the world. I'm curious as to maybe what your most interesting or strange fan encounter is.
Well, I just want to say I agree. They're so dedicated and lovely. I don't know. All I can say is it comes to mind being in in London at the Fright Fest some years ago, and just how wonderful the fans were there. And, you know, I'm missing a front tooth, so I look like a bit of a freak, but all these lovely guys getting my autograph, also missing teeth because it's England. And they're just so, hello, Larry, oh, could you sign our little book? And then, you know, you go there and they've taken their week holiday to go to these horrifying movies with, you know, torture porn and splatter, and yet they're the warmest people. So I guess the answer is that festival. But every horror festival is filled with incredibly generous, warm, often misfits, but often very kind people. And I think it's something about if you, the kinds of fans that are drawn to horror are very dedicated, and they also, they have an access to the dark side of life, which makes them perhaps more merry than others. Whereas I always say comically, endlessly bitter, you know, not funny people off the stage. So anyway, I love the horror community. They're very loyal. They're quite discerning. And they're going to movies that the mainstream disparages. So, you know, we're all outsiders in the genre, and that's kind of awesome. It's the punk rock of movies, of course.
What would you say is your favorite horror film of all time?
Well, I just have my standard answer because it encompasses so many things that I love, and that's Night of the Living Dead. This is a movie that was made for nothing. It was made by a man with great intelligence and ingenuity with a little band of outsiders. They made it in black and white. It's a searing indictment of American culture at the time, racism, which was really by chance that they hired the black dude because someone else fell out, but he was the best actor in their group. And yet it is culturally profoundly relevant. And then it has such a bleak vision. I love that he invented an entire monster, the zombie as we know it now. And of course, he didn't call it a zombie. It was originally Night of the Flesh Eaters. So everything about that movie, the fact that it's black and white, it feels like a fulcrum between the old horror movies I grew up on, like Frankenstein and Dracula, and then the more modern, hard-hitting, brutal movies like Texas Chainsaw. So I always cite that movie. I loved Romero. I loved the he really was also a hero of independent film, and there's a goofiness to it because of the effects and the cheapness, and yet there's something deeply, deeply haunting about that movie. So that's my answer. Obviously, I love The Shining. I love Jaws and Psycho, and really, it's interesting. The classics are the classics for a reason. They just, you can watch them over and over. They are like iconic sculptures of cinema, you know.
What advice would you give to any upcoming, aspiring horror filmmaker?
Well, only put yourself in it. You know, don't abuse horror by just giving us a woman in distress being tortured in a basement. You know, make it something personal that speaks to the greater moment. And also always make your film reflect what's going on. You know, don't be derivative. Try to be original. And don't make movies for movies' sake. We've got plenty of movies. So I just want to hear from the individual people who are challenging themselves to do something authentic. And the other thing is, don't wait around for the big budget. It may never come. So get out there with your friends and learn how to make films on your own outside of the system. And maybe the system will take you in, or maybe not. But either way, it is your film, and you can put it on the shelf and be proud you tried. That's my advice.
Well, the film is Like Me, and it hits theaters in February. Larry Fessenden, thanks so much for your time today.
All right, man. Thanks. Thanks very much.
Alrighty, cheers. Have a good one.
That was my conversation with Larry Fessenden. The movie Like Me opens today. Here is Dala with the song Lennon and McCartney off her 2012 album Best Day.
Take sugar in his cup of coffee. I like honey in my tea. Thinks he's starring in some West Side Story where every girl is 17. He buys records for the virgin vinyl. I scratch I love you in the grooves. Takes me down Romeo. I don't wanna read what Shakespeare wrote. I just wanna feel it, feel it, feel it. Just another guy who lost his glasses, looking for.
Was Lennon and McCartney by Dala. Dala is Amanda Walther and Sheila Carabine. And since 2005, they have released 5 albums, their last coming in 2012 with the release of Best Day. In 2010, they won Vocal Group of the Year at the Canadian Folk Music Awards, as well as the Best Folk Act at the Toronto Independent Music Awards, and in 2011 were nominated for a Juno Award for Roots and Traditional Album of the Year for Dala's Girls from the North Country. I already rambled on enough in the beginning about how much I've loved this group, these two ladies, Amanda and Sheila, since I first saw them open for Matthew Good in Victoria in 2007, if you can believe it, promoting their album, Who Do You Think You Are, which is my favorite album, and that was the song Marilyn Monroe that you heard open the show. Enough of my rambling. Without further ado, here is me and Sheila Carabine of the band Dala.
Sheila Carabine, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks for being here today.
My pleasure.
So, you and Amanda are playing a show here in town on the 27th, on Saturday. What's it like for the two of you to play a show in your hometown?
Oh, it's always a very different kind of preparation involved. We actually rehearse, which is a big deal for us. We had a few rehearsals this month, and we want to tailor the set to, you know, the fans who've been with us from the beginning, and so that means doing, like, old songs that we haven't done in a while, and also introducing some new songs for the people who've come to every single show and heard all of our jokes and stories. We want to, it's good, it keeps us fresh, and it, it keeps us on our toes. I'm really looking forward to it. Also, my whole family will be there, so that always lends itself to a really different dynamic.
You know, obviously, you know, wherever you go, there might be hardcore fans or friends that you know, but what is it like when your family is in the audience and watching everything you do? What does that do in terms of your creative mindset?
It's funny because I've already kind of internalized my mom's Irish critical voice, but to know that she's actually there, it's great, because then in a weird way, you're kind of speaking to the audience, but also directly to your family. So you can have jokes that are very specific to your own personal experiences that they will understand in a different way. And then it's fun to actually tease them, and the rest of the fans, like, knowing that they're in the room is great. So I don't know. It does feel like a weird family. It feels like a family reunion that we get to host, and that is a one-way conversation. So nobody has, like, any recourse to anything we're saying. It's great. I love it.
You know, learning how to be a singer, songwriter, musician is one thing, but learning how to be a performer is another skill. The process for you guys of not only becoming musicians, but learning how to perform for and with audiences at live shows, what was that process like over the years, and how does it evolve over time, do you think?
I love that question, because that's really been our experience has come down to, you know, we started singing and pursuing music thinking that, well, we can write a few songs and, you know, we've got that covered, so we'll be fine. And then, you know, you get thrown in front of different audiences every night, and it's like improv. You know, it's like yesterday's show has no bearing on how tonight's show will be. So it's been an amazing learning experience, and we found that, you know, I went into this, and still I'm quite a perfectionist, and that really, you have to kind of, like, throw that out the window, because the shows that where things have gone wrong have always ended up being the most enjoyable shows for both us and the audience. So I think we've learned to kind of, it forces you to be very present, and you respond to everything that's happening in the room, and you point out the elephant in the room, and it's great. So we've learned that there really are, like, no mistakes. It's completely in how you deal with it. Like, we had a show once where the first, like, we come out, and, you know, it was a huge, there was a packed theater, because it was like subscription series, so people were coming because they knew the theater more than they actually knew us. Like, a lot of people had no idea who we were. So, like, 500 people in Idaho, we walk out, we decide we're going to be really dramatic and play, you know, our first song without even introducing ourselves. And we are both, you know, we play two guitars, and I look over, and just as we're about to hit the first chord, our capos are on different frets, which means that basically it was the most dissonant first chord of all time. So it was like, either we're Stravinsky or this was wrong. And so we play the first chord and then just stopped. And then we started laughing, and it was great, because it got, you know, it got us comfortable. It got the audience on our side. And we were like, well, it can only get better than that. So I think we've learned to use humor, and just, yeah, we try to be real as much as we can.
you mentioned that show took place in Idaho, and, mm-hmm. you know, being Canadians playing in another state or another country, how do you find the audience is maybe similar or different to what you guys are used to here at home?
I mean, we've been lucky enough to be really welcomed into the folk community, both in Canada and the US. And, you know, what that comes down to is that you get to play for audiences that are there to listen so attentively. It's like they can read your mind. And I mean, it's crazy. We've come to just not expected, but you get used to it. And so when you play for an audience, perhaps that is a little chatty and isn't listening, you really realize how lucky you are to play for people who are content to just sit there in silence and really kind of, I don't know, like give like full attention to your words that you've written. And it's been a real privilege to have that. And generally, like, we've been people, I don't know, people love Canadians wherever we've gone. and yeah, we've played a lot in the U.S. Like, we counted recently, I think we've been to like 46 states.
Oh, wow.
So our geography's gotten a lot better. But it's great. I mean, I think playing for a listening audience, no matter what country it's in, that's really been our experience to this point. And yeah, it's been, we're very lucky, because when we first started playing, that was not the case. Like, our earliest shows were, we played the Filly and Firkin in Aurora, Ontario, where we were basically competing with like the TV playing like Hockey Night in Canada behind us. So yeah, we're very grateful that that's not the case anymore.
you know, you talked about how some people might come to the show because they know the theater better than you guys. Mm-hmm. And I remember mm-hmm. when I first saw you guys, you were the opening band for Matthew Good.
Oh, no way.
This was 2005, I want to say, something like that.
It was ages ago.
In Victoria.
Nice.
When you guys are sort of supporting somebody else and knowing that the people who are watching you are, the majority of them are there because they're fans of the other person that you are playing with, how do you sort of get into the mindset where, like, okay, how do we make these guys like us or know who we are?
Yeah, well, first, like, there's so many key things you just said. First of all, that tour was, I'm looking at, it's 2007, and we, the Victoria show was the first show of that tour. So we were meeting him for the first time and also playing for his audience for the first time. So we were pretty nervous, particularly because it was, well, we walked out and I think it was mostly guys in the room. So it was definitely a room full of guys who had never heard of us. And I love that challenge. Like, Amanda and I both just, we take such delight in coming out and kind of knowing that people are like, oh my gosh, when will the opening act be over? It's like, just sing your hit, sing the chorus and get out of here, right? But we would point that out and make fun of it and be like, so you guys have no idea who we are. And it's great. You kind of like, you just break the ice and then you hope for the best, really. You can only do your best, and they like it, they like it. If they don't, you're off there in 15 minutes. It doesn't really matter. But I really enjoyed coming out with people having no expectations for us and then trying to dazzle them. There was something really fun in that challenge. And also, with a really short set, you just get to play like your favorite songs and you know, just go on Facebook for the rest of the night.
Now, I know you and Amanda met at Catholic school. Mm-hmm. And I'm curious how maybe that upbringing or that environment influenced or affected you on a creative level?
Oh, that's so interesting. Well, a few things that I remember distinctly about growing up going to Catholic high school was that I didn't have to buy, you know, cool clothes for 5 years because I was wearing a uniform, which was great. But that also meant that when I came out and had to go to university, I had, you know, nothing to wear. And the other experience was that growing up, my parents would take us to mass. And so you're surrounded by hymns, and it was a great place to kind of test out harmonies because everybody was singing. And if, you know, you tried something, it didn't sound right, because I could never sing in like the people's key of C because I have a lower voice. So I'd always be trying lower harmonies, and, you know, you kind of blend your voice in and try different things and it didn't matter. It was a non-judgmental kind of atmosphere. So I think because of that, but more so than like the Catholic upbringing, Amanda and I grew up listening to our dad's records, and in a way that was like our musical, that was our formative kind of process. Was we would listen to the Beatles, Cat Stevens, Christa Berg, and so when we met each other, we had both kind of gone to the same like church of pop and folk music. So I think that's where we really found our common ground, was that we have all the same kind of musical reference points. And so when we write music together, our ears are kind of going towards the same place, and it makes the editing process really quick because we generally like and dislike the same things.
On that note, the songwriting process for you two, how does that work? Do you always write together? Do you write separately? Does one of you take charge of the lyrics? One of you take charge of the music?
Generally, in the beginning, we would sit down and start, you know, with a very vague, abstract idea, and then, you know, build the song from like bare bones to some sort of structure. But now when we write, generally, you know, one person will come with almost a complete song, and then, you know, the other person will give like maybe the thumbs up or the, because we like to kind of run it by each other. I think we trust each other's opinions, like the gold standard a little bit. Like, I don't feel like the song is done for me until I know that Amanda's on board. But she's kind of the melody machine. Amanda could write a melody, you know, over this course of this interview, she could probably write like 15 melodies that she could sell to any ad agency and, like, I don't know, sell like Tide Pods or something. But for me, I think I'm more wordy, as I'm sure you can gather from my very long answers. So the words really jump out to me. And Amanda is probably more like the expert melody writer. So that's kind of, we play to those strengths, I think.
So are we gonna be seeing a new Dala album in the near future?
We actually, as we were rehearsing for this show coming up on Saturday, Amanda's already written like 2 new songs since we wrote our original set list. So those ones are going to be in the set. So we've got a lot of new material. It's just a matter of finding the time to, you know, get in the studio and make it just right. But yeah, we haven't got any immediate plans, but we definitely have enough songs for at least one album. So.
So what is, you know, you guys have been on the road now for about 10, 12 years. What is your favorite, memory from touring?
Oh my gosh. I was just thinking about this. I was reminiscing recently because I keep a Dallas scrapbook. I have all these little, you know, posters from shows and little notes we might've left each other and like notes from fans. Oh my goodness, there was one show, I've blanked on, I was just telling somebody about it. There was one show where we arrived, I'm not going to say where it was, but the marquee was up and like the venue had spelled their own name wrong. We're like, this doesn't bode well. And then it was just one of those, like, it was like entering an alternate universe where everything was slightly off. And you know, the whole, there's like the rule of like, you never blame the audience if the show is not going well.
Right.
I'm going to say that this show was the exception. But yeah, I don't know. We've been pretty lucky. It's like, it's gone pretty smoothly, knock on wood, up to this point. The minute we finish this interview, I'm going to remember this one story that I was telling somebody about a crazy show. But yeah, the fact that I can't, it's funny how like your memory is quite selective. Like generally I have only positive memories of our time on the road because it has been, I was watching Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee recently, and there's a quote from Alec Baldwin describing Jerry Seinfeld's career. He's like, man, your life has just been one unbroken boulevard of green lights. So I'm like, that's how Dallas' career feels.
What do you make of the not only the indie music scene in Canada and Toronto, but the folk music scene in particular?
Oh, I mean, it's they've been saying it's been a revival for the last 10 years, which is great. It just means that, you know, there's always this instinct to kind of discount people's interest in authentic and music with integrity, and that all, you know, people are just going to fall for the ruse of pop music. And that's never been the case. Like, people love pop music and they love folk music equally. And there's always an appetite for new music. And I think particularly I think that people are so empowered with technology that it's never been a more opportune time to kind of make your own music and get it out to an audience. Like, there's really nothing holding people back. So, in a way, it's more crowded than ever, and that's great because there are so many more voices available to people. So, yeah, I think that the revival is continuing and will continue forever because I think people's attention span gets shorter and they want something new quicker, and I think that there are just more people at the table, which is great.
But, do you think the industry has changed a lot since you guys first started out?
Oh, yeah. Oh, there's no question. Like, when we started, like the holy grail was to get a record deal. And now I don't hear anybody ever talking about that. Like, that's not even an issue because you can just record a song, put it online, make your own video with your iPhone and put it on YouTube. And then you can be a sensation because in a way it's like the cream will rise much quicker now. And there, you don't need all these intermediaries kind of, you know, blocking you from your audience. Like, it's so much more immediate. So I think in that sense, yeah, it's almost like it's overwhelmingly, the opportunities are just infinite at this point. So, yeah, it's an empowering time to be an artist, I think. But at the same time, it's also, it's hard to get paid because it is so available and so disposable. And I think that it's hard for people to kind of like valorize that and to put their money where their downloads are.
What is your favorite Dallas song to perform live?
Man, these questions are making me think. I'm not even awake yet. It's noon. I just woke up. My favorite song to perform live. I mean, different song. Like we play Horses at every show, and that song seems to have really resonated with people. And it's always like a moment in the show where I feel like we end up in a different place than when we started. Like it does feel like the audience goes with us somewhere, and people are quite moved visibly, and that always affects us on stage. But I always love, you know, I love playing a cover that people haven't heard us do before. And I love like by the third line, they figured out what it is. Cause we always try to do a different spin. So recently we've been playing Witchy Woman by the Eagles, and I don't know, it's just great seeing people's eyes light up and this recognition that happens between us and them. So I kind of like trying to surprise people.
What is it about playing music by somebody else that can give you a different type of fulfillment?
I think because people already have such a personal history with the song. So in a way, it's like it accelerates it accelerates the ice-breaking process that will happen at a show. So if you walk out and they've never seen you before, but you play something that they already know, it's like, I don't know, it's like you're meeting someone at a party and you make one reference to a show that they've watched the whole season of, and then suddenly you feel like, oh, I have this common ground. I know that we have the same background, the same reference points. It puts you at ease. It puts them at ease. You both open a little more to each other. It allows, I don't know, like real recognition and like real, I guess like real connection to happen. So that's our goal always, is just to find a way to connect with people so that we feel a little more open and that you can feel the room just kind of like asking you to like take it further, you know?
Besides your family, what are you most looking forward to about the show on Saturday?
I love having my family here. I have two older brothers and they make me laugh more than anyone. Like we have an ongoing like text history that is just my favorite thing. I wish I could frame it. I'd need like a really long frame, but I'm definitely looking forward to playing for, I think it's like 300 people sold out, standing on stage with my very best friend and then having no idea what we're going to do next, because we always walk out even though we've planned it to a T, and then it just all plans go out the window. And I'm looking forward to the unexpected things, to things possibly going wrong, and to the jokes that will happen that I could not possibly have foreseen. So,
do you think you'll ever turn the text between you and your brother into a song?
If I did, it would mostly be references to like John Tesh, Led Zeppelin, and then like a million like Google images, like stock footage of Spinal Tap. It's so stupid, but it's, you know, there's nothing like family jokes. I live for it.
All right. Well, yeah, Dala will be playing this Saturday, the 27th at Danforth? No.
We are playing at, we're playing at the Toronto Centre for the Arts. There's the Greenwind Theatre. It used to be the Ford Centre.
Right.
It was up at like Sheppard and Yonge. You can get your passport renewed in the process, go to Melaston Square, and then come to our show.
Well, there you go.
There you go.
Just make a night out of it. Sheila Carabine, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you very much.
Alrighty, cheers.
Cheers.
And that was my conversation with Sheila Carabine, who is one half of the Juno-nominated Canadian folk duo Dala, along with her best friend, Amanda Walder. They talked about, who knows, maybe there might be a new album in the future. So when that comes out, I'd love to have them on again, and maybe we'll do one of those hour-long feature chats that have been happening for me a couple of times this year. Or, you know, I'll just direct a music video. No, I'm kidding. I should cut that out. Anyway, that's it for me today. We're going to take you out with Horses by Dala off their album, Everyone is Someone. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now.
the sound of the world outside. 'Cause everybody coming here can't wait to say goodbye. And I followed your car to my childhood home. And I looked for the key hidden under the stone. And I still from my window, they were watching all the cars go, and they don't care that I am broken. Close my eyes and run beside them. When I'm already free, and I'm already free. So don't I run.